any other proposed way of getting Sanchia to the mountain? Asked Gregor. There was a long silence. Well, said Gregor, it seems this is our choice for now. Sanchia sighed. Can we at least call it something besides a casket, then? This just leaves the issue of the mountain itself, said Gregor, getting Sanchia up to Ziani's office.
I'm working on a way to give her access, said Orso. But access doesn't mean there won't be obstacles. I haven't seen the inside of the mountain in a decade. I've no idea what could have changed. And I understand very little about how the thing really works.
Gregor turned to Berenice.
There's nothing in Tribuno's notes about this? Nothing about how he designed the mountain?
She shook her head.
What is in Tribuno Candiano's notes? Said Giovanni. I'd be curious to see the writings of our most acclaimed genius and madman.
Well, said Berenice reluctantly, there's all these wax rubbings of what looks like human sacrifices, a body on an altar, and a dagger above. But as for Tribuno's notes,
she cleared her throat and read aloud,
I again return to the nature of this ritual. The Hierophant Seleikos refers to a collection of energies, or a focusing of minds and thoughts, all captured. The Great Pharnaces refers to a transaction or deliverance or transference of sorts that must take place at the world's newest hour. At other times, he says it must be at the darkest hour or the forgotten minute. Does he mean midnight? The winter solstice? Something else?
Giovanni stared at her blankly.
What the hell is that? Tribuno's efforts to determine the source of the Hierophant's nature, said Orso. In other words, a hell of a bigger problem than what we're trying to solve here.
It's not as useful as I hoped, said Berenice. He just goes on and on about this transaction, the filling of the pitchers, though it's pretty clear Tribuno himself doesn't understand what he's talking about.
But obviously it was of great value to Tomas Ziani, said Gregor.
Or he just thought it was of value, said Orso. And he's wasting blood and treasure on nonsense.
At that comment, Gregor froze. Ah, he said softly.
Ah, what? Said Sanchia.
Gregor stared into the middle distance.
Blood, he said quietly.
A look of horrible revelation entered his face.
Tell me, Orso, does Estelle Ziani ever see her father?
Estelle? Why?
Asked Orso suspiciously.
He's ill, isn't he?
He looked at Orso and narrowed his eyes.
Surely she oversees his magical attention. Yes, Orso?
Orso was very still.
Ah, well.
The mountain checks the blood of a person to make sure they're the right person,
Gregor said.
You'd have to find a way to log your own blood with the mountain in order to let you in.
He stepped closer to Orso.
But what if you had access to the blood of a resident, like Estelle Ziani, or better yet, her father, the man who made the mountain itself? That's what you aim to do, isn't it, Orso? To use Tribuno Candiano's blood as a passkey for Sanchia.
Orso glared at him.
Well, aren't you a clever bastard, Captain?
Wait, said Sanchia. You're going to steal Tribuno Candiano's blood? Really? Everyone stared at Orso. Finally, he sighed.
I never said steal. He said huffily. It would be voluntarily donated. I thought I'd just, you know, ask Estelle for it.
You can't be serious, said Claudia.
What? He said. It's an opportunity we can't pass up. With his blood, the damned thing should open for her like a schoolgirl's legs. The mountain's a kingdom, riddled with scribed guards, and no guard can turn away their king.
And what, I cover myself with his blood? Asked Sanchia. She pulled a face. That's not exactly stealthy.
I'm sure we can make some kind of container for it, he said, exasperated.
Assuming Estelle even consents, said Berenice. Surely the Candianos have rewritten all the permissions, so Tribuno no longer has access, yes?
That would suggest there's someone on the Candiano Campo who's a better scriver than Tribuno, said Orso, which is unlikely. If I'd scribed my own massive house, I'd have put in all kinds of permissions and goodies just for me.
And Ziani certainly isn't a scriver, said Gio. But all this assumes our boy here can actually get the man's blood.
You really think that Estelle would do that for you, Orso? Asked Sanchia.
She might, if I tell her you saw her husband kissing hips with some girl in a run-down foundry, said Orso. Or maybe I don't even need to say that. Everyone knows Ziani is a privileged shit, and from the sound of it, he practically keeps her shackled up in the mountain. I suspect she wouldn't turn down a way to stick a knife in Ziani's ribs.
True, said Berenice. Maybe it's not as heavy an ask as we're all assuming. In a way, you'd be offering her freedom, and people risk many things for that. Then a curious thing happened. A deeply guilty look crossed Gregor's face, and he turned to Sanchia and opened his mouth as if to say something. Then he seemed to think better of it, and he shut his mouth and was silent for the rest of the night. Much later, they slept, and Sanchia's dreams were filled with old memories. She had never known her parents. Either she or they had been sold before she could know them, and instead she'd become, like so many slave children, a communal burden on the shifting assortment of women all crammed together in the quarters on the plantation. In some ways, Sanchia'd had not one mother, but 30. All indistinct. Except one. Ardita, a Gothian woman. She was a ghost to Sanchia now, and all she retained were flashes of the woman's dark eyes, the wrinkles of her olive-colored skin on her hard, scarred hands, her jet-black ringlets, and the way her smile showed the far-back teeth in her wide mouth. "There are many dangers here, child," she'd said once. "Many. Many ugly things you're going to have to do. It will be a great contest for you. And you're going to think, how do I win? And the answer is, so long as you are alive, you are winning. The only hope you should ever have is to see the next day and the next. Some here will whisper of liberty, but you can't be free if you aren't alive." And then, one day, Ardita had been gone. It had not been commented upon in the quarters, perhaps because such things were common and forgettable, or perhaps because nothing needed to be said. Some time later, Sanchia and the other children had been led to a new field to work, and they'd walked by a tree full of corpses hanging from ropes, slaves who had been executed for any number of crimes. The overseer called out,
"Look well, little ones, look well and see what's done to those who disobey."
And Sanchia had looked up into the canopy of leaves and seen a woman suspended in the branches, her feet and hands hacked off. And Sanchia had thought she'd spied jet-black ringlets on the corpse's shoulders and a wide, toothy mouth. In the darkness of the crypt, Sanchia awoke. She heard snores and soft sighs from the others. She stared at the dark stone ceiling and thought about what these people were proposing she do, the enormous risks they were asking her to take. Is this survival?
Is this liberty?
Beats the hell out of me, kid, said Clef's voice, soft and sad.
Chapter 22 Orso stood in front of the closed-down taverna and tried not to sweat. He had many reasons to. For one, he was wearing quite a lot of clothes, in a clumsy attempt to disguise himself. For another, he was on the Candiano Campo using a false sachet that Claudia and Giovanni had supplied him with. And for another, there was a significant chance that none of this ploy could work. She might not come, and then they'd have wasted another day. He turned around and looked at the taverna. It was old and crumbling, its moss clay cracking, its windows broken or gone. The canal it overlooked was not the blossoming, picturesque stream Orso remembered, but a fetid, reeking mire. Nearly all of the balconies were gone, apparently fallen away. But one remained. Orso stared at the balcony. He remembered how it had looked 20 years ago, the lights around it bright and beautiful, the smell of wine and flowers, and how beautiful she'd looked that night, until he'd spoken his heart.
That's not true, he thought. She was still beautiful, even after that.
He sighed and leaned against the fence.
She won't come, he thought. Why would she come to this painful memory? Why am I even here?
Then he heard footsteps in the alley behind. He turned and saw a woman approaching, dressed like a house servant, wearing a muddy-colored dress and a dull, unadorned wimple that covered most of her face. She walked right up to him, her eyes steady and still.
"The theatrics of youth," she said, "are unbecoming to aged folk such as we."
"I'm a hell of a lot more aged than you are," he said. "I think I have more right to say what's unbecoming and what isn't. I'm amazed you're here. I can't believe you still had it, that it worked."
"I kept the hand harp for lots of reasons or so," said Estelle. "Some sentimental, but also because I made it, and I think I did a good job."
She was referring to the twinned hand harp she'd scribed, back when she and Orso had been young and attempting to be surreptitious with their relationship. It had been their way of communicating. Pluck a certain series of strings, and the other harp would make the same tune. Each note had been a code for where and when they should meet. And this taverna had once been a favorite of theirs. Orso had always kept his harp, perhaps out of fondness. He'd had no idea he'd need it again one day. Certainly not for this. She peered at the taverna.
"So many things have dried up and faded away on the campo," she said quietly, "that it feels odd to mourn the loss of a single taverna. Yet I do."
"If I could have gotten a message to you to meet somewhere else," he said, "I would have."
"Shall we go inside?" said Estelle.
"Really? It looks like it's falling apart."
"You're the one who started me reliving my memories or so, when you plucked the harp. I wish to continue."
They walked up the steps and through the broken doors. The vaulted ceilings were still intact, as were the tiled floors. But that was about it. The tables were gone, the bar had fallen to pieces, and vines were erupting from the walls.
"I take it," she said quietly as she walked through the ruins, "that you're not here to whisk me away and make me your own."
"No," said Orso. "I have something to ask of you."
"Of course. A sentimental tool, a sentimental place, used for unsentimental ends."
"I need something from you, Estelle. Something mad."
"How mad? And why?"
He told her only what she needed to know. She listened quietly.
"So," she said, "you think my father was close to figuring out how the Hierophants made their tools. And you think my husband is now trying to duplicate his efforts, and has killed many people in the process?
Yes.
She stared out the windows at the one remaining balcony. And you need my father's blood to make it through the mountain, to steal this device from Tomas and cripple his efforts.
Yes. Will you help us?
She blinked slowly. That was the place, wasn't it? She whispered. He looked and saw she meant the balcony before them.
Yes, he said. It was.
I want to see it.
It looks terribly unsafe.
I said see, not stand on. She walked over to the doors, reached out to open them, and then winced and grabbed her side. Ah, I'm sorry. Orso, can you?
Certainly, he said.
He walked over to the doors and opened them for her. Thank you, she said. She looked out at the balcony and the dreary sight of the canal below. She sighed, like the sight of it pained her.
Are you hurt, Estelle?
He said. I fell recently. I hurt my elbow, I'm afraid.
You fell?
Yes, while climbing the stairs. He watched her for a long time, looking her over. Was he imagining it, or was she standing somewhat crooked, as if walking on a ginger knee?
You didn't fall, did you?
He said. She said nothing.
It was Tomas, he said. He did this to you, didn't he?
She was still for a long time. Why did you leave, Orso? Why did you leave the house? Why did you leave me there alone with my father? Orso was silent as he thought about how to answer.
I asked you to marry me, he said.
Yes.
On this very balcony.
Yes.
And you said no. Because of the inheritance laws on the Campo, everything you owned would go to me. You said you wanted to prove to your father that you could be as good as him, that you could be a scriver, a leader, someone who could guide the house. You thought he could change the rules for you, but I knew he wouldn't ever do that. Tribuno was a four-sided man in many ways, but he was also terribly traditional.
Traditional? She echoed. What a curious word that is. So bland, and yet often so poisonous.
He mentioned it to me once. Asked me why we weren't engaged yet. I told him you were considering your options. And he said, if you want or so, I could just make her. As if I would ask for that. As if having you by force was the same as having you. So there I was, stuck between two people I found increasingly unpleasant or painful.
I see, she said quietly.
I'm sorry,
said Orso.
I'm sorry for all that's happened to you. If I'd known how things were going to go, if I'd known how deeply in debt Tribuno had gone, I'd...
You'd what?
I've tried to steal you away, I guess. Flee the city, go somewhere new, and leave all this behind.
She laughed quietly. Oh, or so. I knew you were still a romantic, down underneath it all. Don't you see? I'd never have left. I'd have stayed and fought for what I felt I was due. She grew solemn. I'll help you.
You will?
Yes. Father gets bled frequently for his condition, and I know a way into the mountain, a way designed just for him, one Tomas has never known about.
Really?
Said Orso, astonished.
Yes. Father grew secretive in the later years, as you know, when he was buying up all that historical junk, spending thousands of devats a day. He wanted to move freely, without anyone being aware of it. She told him when and where he could expect to receive Tribuno's blood, and where the secret entrance could be found. "It'll open up for whoever's carrying the blood," she said, "though you must keep the blood cooled. If it decays too much, it'll be useless. This means you'll have a short time period to get this done. You need to do it in 3 nights, essentially."
3 days to prepare?" he said. "God."
"It gets worse," said Estelle. "Because the mountain will probably figure out that the person you've sent in is not my father, eventually. I doubt if they'll be able to leave the way they came in." Orso thought about it.
"We can fly her out, maybe. Use an anchor somewhere in the city. Pull her to it. She's done such things before."
"A dangerous flight, but it might be your only option." He glanced at her.
"And if we pull this off, what happens to you, Estelle?"
She smiled weakly and shrugged. "Who knows? Maybe they'll let me take charge. Maybe I'll get a moment of freedom before they bring in another ruthless merchant to run things. Or maybe they'll suspect me immediately and execute me." Orso swallowed.
"Please take care of yourself, Estelle."
"Don't worry, Orso. I always do." Chapter 23 For the next 2 days, they worked. Sanchia had seen the scrappers scribe and alter devices before, but that was nothing compared to this. Berenice brought in raw iron ingots, and using the scribed cauldrons and devices they'd procured, they began to build the capsule from scratch, plate by plate and rib by rib. By the end of the first day, it had started to resemble a huge metal seed pod, about 6 feet long and 3 feet in diameter, with a small hatch set in the center. But though the sight of Berenice, Claudia, and Giovanni fabricating this thing out of raw metal was amazing, it didn't exactly make Sanchia feel relaxed.
"Doesn't seem like there's a lot of breathing room in there," she said.
"There will be," said Berenice, "and it will be quite safe. We'll apply bracing and durability sigils to the entirety of the capsule, along with waterproofing, of course."
"How in the hell is this thing going to move around?" said Sanchia.
"Well, that's been tricky, but your friends here have come up with a clever idea that might work."
"Floating lanterns," said Gio cheerfully.
"What do they have to do with this?" asked Sanchia.
"Floating lanterns are scribed to believe they've got a big balloon in them," explained Claudia. "And then, on the campos, they follow guided paths along markers placed on the ground."
"Only this marker will be on the barge," said Gio. "It'll keep you a set distance below the water."
"And how do I get out of the water?"
"You hit this switch here." Berenice pointed to the interior of the capsule. "This will make the capsule float up and surface."
"Then you climb out, shut the hatch,"
said Gio, pointing to a button on the outside of the capsule.
"Hit this and it'll sink. Then you're all set. Somewhat. Except for the mountain bit."
"Orso's working on that," said Berenice testily.
"One would hope," said Gio.
Sanchia stared at the capsule. She imagined being crammed inside the tiny thing.
"God, now I sort of wish I'd let Gregor lock me up."
"Speaking of which," said Claudia, looking around, "where is the captain?"
"He said he had business to attend to," said Berenice, "back on the campo."
"What business could possibly be more important than this?" asked Claudia.
Berenice shrugged. "He mentioned putting a matter to rest, something that had been bothering him. When I saw the look on his face, I didn't ask more."
She quickly scrawled out a line of sigils.
"Now, let's make sure this thing is really waterproof."
Gregor Dandolo was good at waiting. Most of military life was nothing but waiting. Waiting for orders, waiting for supplies, waiting for the weather to change, or just trying to outwait your opponent, baiting them into doing something. Yet Gregor had been waiting in front of the Dandolo-chartered Vienzi site foundry for 3 hours now. And since he had much better things to do that day, and since, theoretically, Tomas Ziani's thugs could try to kill him even there, this was really pushing it. He looked back at the front gates of the Vienzi site foundry. He'd been told this was where he could find his mother, and this did not surprise him. The Vienzi was one of the newest Dandolo foundries, built to perform some of the company's most complicated production. He'd known that few were allowed inside, but he'd assumed that he, being Ophelia's son, would be granted entrance. And yet, he'd been simply told to wait.
"I wonder what percentage of my life," he thought, "has been spent waiting for my mother's attentions. 5%? 10%? More?"
Finally, there was a creak from the massive foundry gates, and the giant oak door began to swing open. Ophelia Dandolo did not wait for the gate to fall completely open. She slipped through the crack, small and white and frail against the huge door, and calmly walked toward him.
"Good morning, Gregor," she said. "What a pleasure it is to see you so soon again. How is your investigation going? Have you found the perpetrator?"
"I have encountered, how shall I put this, more questions," said Gregor, "some of which I've been turning over for some time. But I thought it was time to discuss a certain matter with you, personally."
"A matter," said Ophelia.
"What threateningly bland language. What would you like to talk to me about?"
He took a breath.
"I wanted to ask you about the Silicio plantation, mother."
Ophelia Dandolo slowly raised an eyebrow.
"Do you know anything about that, mother?"
asked Gregor, "about what it is, what they did there."
"What I've heard, Gregor," she said, "are mostly rumors that you've been involved, somehow, in some of the violence in the wake of the foundry side blackout. Armed gangs fighting in the streets, carriages crashing into walls, and somewhere among it all, my son. Is this true, Gregor?"
"Please stop trying to change the subject." "Rumors of you and some street urchin," said Ophelia, "being shot at by a team of assassins. That must be fantasy, mustn't it? Answer me. Why are you asking me this anyway? Who poured this poison in your ear, Gregor?"
"I will make my question clear beyond doubt," said Gregor, forcefully. "Is Dandolo chartered? My grandfather's company, my father's company, and your company, mother. Is it involved in the gruesome practice of attempting to scribe the human body and soul?"
She looked at him levelly.
"No, it is not."
Gregor nodded.
"A second question," he said. "Was it ever involved in such a practice?"
There was a soft hiss as Ophelia exhaled through her nose.
"Yes," she said softly.
He stared at her.
"It was.
It was?"
"Yes," she said reluctantly.
"Once."
Gregor tried to think, yet he found he could not. Orso had said as much, and the comment had slowly worked its way into Gregor's mind, like a needle. Yet he'd been unable to believe it.
How could you?
"I did not know," she said, shaken, "until after your father died. Until after your accident, Gregor, when I took over the company."
"You're saying father was the one involved in it? It was his program?"
"It was a different time, Gregor," said Ophelia.
The Enlightenment Wars were just beginning. We didn't understand what we were truly doing, neither as rulers of the Durazzo nor as scrivers. And all of our competitors were doing the same. If we hadn't pursued this as well, we might have been ruined.
Such excuses, said Gregor. All end the same way, Mother, with graves and heartache.
I put a stop to it when I took charge, she said fiercely. I killed the project. It was wrong, and we didn't need it anymore anyway.
Why not?
She paused, as if she hadn't meant to say that. Because scribing had changed so much by then. Our lexicon technology had given us an impregnable position. The scribing of the body was no longer worth researching. It wasn't possible anyway.
Gregor did not say, of course, that he was now acquainted with a living specimen that suggested otherwise.
I just so wish that we had one good thing, he said. One good thing in Tavan that was not born from ugliness. Oh, spare me your righteousness, she snapped. Your father did what was deemed necessary. He did his duty. And ever since Dantua, you, Gregor, have been fleeing your duties as a rat might a wildfire.
He stared at her, scandalized.
What? How can you say that? How can you?
Shut up, she said, and come with me. She turned and started walking back into the Vienzi site. Gregor paused for a moment, glowering, then did as she asked. The guards and operators did double takes as Gregor entered the gates, but they stood down at the sight of Ophelia, jaw set and eyes glittering with fury. Gregor saw that the Vienzi site was indeed far more advanced than any scribing foundry he'd yet been in. Pipes of formulas and waters and reagents rose out of the stone foundation in countless places and twisted and tangled together before sinking into the walls. Tremendous cauldrons and crucibles glowed with a manic, cheery red light, brimming with molten bronze or tin or copper. Yet Ophelia ignored all of this and led Gregor to a warehouse in the back of the yard. This warehouse was heavily guarded. Dandolo officers in scribed armor stood at attention before its doors. They glanced at Gregor, but said nothing. Gregor walked inside, wondering what on the foundry yard could possibly call for such defenses. And then he saw it. Or he thought he saw it. Sitting in the middle of the warehouse was a shadow, a ball of almost solid darkness. He thought he could identify a shape in the darkness, but it was difficult to tell. A handful of moths flitted in and out of the shadows, and when they entered that vague line of darkness, they almost seemed to disappear.
What? What is that? Asked Gregor.
Ophelia didn't answer. She strode across the warehouse to a panel of bronze dials and switches on the walls. She flipped one, and the circle of shadow vanished. A wooden frame in the outline of a person stood in the exact center of where the ball of darkness had been, and hanging on this frame was a scribed suit of armor. But it was a tremendously strange suit of armor. Built into one arm was a black, glittering polearm, half massive axe, half giant spear. Built into the other was a huge round shield, and installed behind it, a scribed bolt caster. But the strangest thing about it was the curious black plate situated on the front of its cuirass.
Is this a Lorica?
Asked Gregor.
No, said Ophelia. A Lorica is a big, loud, ugly armament of open warfare, a scribed suit intended solely for slaughter. It is also illegal, since it augments gravity in manners that violate our unspoken laws. But this is different. She touched the black plate on its front with a finger. The rig is fast, graceful, and difficult to see coming. It absorbs light to a phenomenal degree, making it almost impossible to discern with the eyes. Something Orso designed. Orso made this? He made the method. But this method is critical to our house's survival. Gregor frowned at the suit as an uncomfortable idea entered his mind. This is a tool of assassins, he said.
You've heard the rumors as well as I have, said Ophelia. Flying men with the springles leaping over Campo walls. Sieges and bloodshed in the commons. We enter a dangerous era now, Gregor. An age of escalation and broken promises. The houses have grown complacent, and ambitious men have gained seats of power. It is inevitable, one day, some bright young man will say, we're quite skilled at waging war abroad, so why not do it here? And when that happens, we must be ready to respond. Gregor knew she was right. Whether she knew it or not, that description perfectly fit Tomas Ziani, but the words filled him with horror. Respond how? She steeled herself, her face serious. A moth flitted around her head in a lazy circle before meandering away. We must leave them leaderless, she said, and unable to respond. A single quick strike. You're not serious. If you think the Morsinis or the Michiels or even the Candianos aren't doing the same, you're being foolish, Gregor, she said. They are. I've seen the intelligence reports, and when it happens, Gregor, I want for you to lead our forces.
His mouth fell open.
What? You have more experience in the field than any living Tavani, she said. You have spent your life in war, as your city asked you to. Your war was harder than others, and I regret that. But now I ask you as your mother, Gregor. Please, please leave all these diversions of yours and come back to me.
Gregor swallowed. He looked at his mother, then at the shadowy armor, and thought for a long time.
I don't remember, Domenico,
he said suddenly.
Did you know that?
She blinked, surprised.
What? I don't remember my brother. I remember him dying, but that's all. A father, I have nothing, no memory at all. Both of them are lost to me since the accident.
He turned back to her.
I want to miss them, but I don't know how, because I never really knew them. To me, mother, they are both just creatures in a painting that hangs outside your office. Noble ghosts I can never quite live up to. But do you grieve them? Does their loss wound you, mother?
Gregor,
you lost Domenico and father,
he said, voice shaking,
and you lost me. I nearly died in Dantua. Would you risk me again? Again? Is that how you think of me, as something so expendable?
I did not lose you in Dantua, she said fiercely.
You survived, as I knew you would, Gregor. As I know you always will. Why? Why this certainty?
That his mother could not answer. It seemed, for the first time, like Gregor had deeply wounded her. And curiously, he felt no regrets.
I have lived my life in war, he said to her. I returned to Tavan to find civilization. It was not as civilized as I liked, mother. So, I shall focus on amending that, and nothing more.
Then he turned and walked away. Chapter 24. On the third day, they finished their preparations, hastily crafting each tool and each design. Orso oversaw their efforts, pacing around the capsule, reviewing the chalkboards and scribing blocks, carefully eyeing every string of sigils. He twitched and groaned and huffed,
but though the designs were not up to his standards, he felt they would work. The stone door creaked open and Gregor strode in.
A fine time to pop in, snapped Orso. We've had some last-minute changes that have thrown everything into goddamn chaos, and we damned sure could have used you.
I need to talk to you, Orso, he said.
He pulled him aside.
What the hell's the matter, Captain?
Asked Orso.
Gregor leaned close. Did you develop some kind of light-absorbing rig for my mother, Orso?
What? How the hell did you know about that?
Gregor told him about the meeting with his mother. Orso was stunned.
She's making some kind of assassin's Lorica? In essence. But my god, Ophelia Dandolo never struck me as the type at all for plots and coups and revolutions.
So you knew nothing of this? Asked Gregor.
Not a word.
Gregor nodded, his face grave.
It's nothing I can do much about right now. I'm not even sure what to do, frankly. But it makes me wonder.
Wonder what?
If her house Sepatis had no idea this was happening, what other secrets is she keeping?
What's that? Asked Sanchia loudly. She pointed at a rig on the far table. Orso looked over his shoulder.
Oh, that. We'll get to that in a minute.
It looks like an air sailing rig, said Sanchia.
We'll get to that. And you haven't mentioned an air sailing rig yet. I said we'll get to that.
They applied the last few finishing touches, then they regrouped around the map, and Orso reviewed the plan, step by step.
First, we bring the capsule to this part of the commons, he said.
He pointed at a stretch of canal on the map.
The delivery canal passes through there. Sanchia will enter the capsule. It will submerge, and as the barge passes through, Berenice will plant the marker. Got it?
Yes, sir, said Berenice.
The barge then pulls Sanchia, he traced the canal with a finger, right up to the mountain's dock. It's a big dock and well guarded, which is why the marker will put 100 feet between the capsule and the barge. That should give Sanchia enough distance to safely surface and slip out without anyone noticing. Yes?
Sanchia said nothing.
Sanchia then goes to here.
He pointed at a spot outside the mountain.
The sculpture gardens. That's where Tribuno's secret entrance is hidden. It's apparently been cleverly concealed underneath a small white stone bridge. It's literally invisible, unless you have this.
He pointed at a small bronze box on the table. The smooth metal was covered in condensation.
It's a cooling casket, and inside is a vial of Tribuno's blood, procured by his daughter.
Everyone stared at the bronze box. Gregor wrinkled his nose.
The secret entrance will react to Tribuno's blood and open up for Sanchia, said Orso. She then enters, goes through the passageway, and then she'll be in the mountain.
Sanchia cleared her throat and said, Where in the mountain exactly?
On the fourth floor, said Orso.
Where on the fourth floor?
That I don't know.
You don't know?
No. But you'll need to get up to the 35th floor. That's where Ziani's office is. And that's where the Imperiat almost certainly is as well.
What's the process for getting to the 35th floor? Asked Sanchia. Orso considered what to say.
You don't know, said Sanchia.
No,
he said honestly.
I don't, but whatever's in your way, Tribuno's blood should trump it. It'll be a candle in the dark for you, girl.
Sanchia took a slow breath in. And once I have the Imperiat, I just walk out, yes? Orso hesitated. Claudia, Berenice, and Gio suddenly looked tense.
Well, we've had some change of plans there.
Have you? Said Sanchia.
Yes. Because there's a good chance the mountain will eventually figure out you're not Tribuno. Which means getting out might be a lot trickier than getting in. Hence the sailing rig.
Sanchia stared at them. You want me to fly off the side of the mountain?
There's a balcony in Tribuno's office, said Orso. You grab the Imperiet, hop out, tear off this bronze tab here,
he pointed on the rig,
and off you go. The parachute activates and you're pulled to safety. There's also a hardened cask secured to the rig. You can put the Imperiet in there to make sure it doesn't see any harm.
And you can't make a hardened cask that could hold me?
Well, no. That would be heavy. Now, we can't fabricate an anchor with a range to pull you completely out of the campo, but we can get someone onto the Candiano campo to create a sort of landing zone close to one of the gates.
He looked at Gregor.
Are you amenable to this task, Captain?
Gregor considered it.
So I just take the anchor onto the campo, plant it somewhere in range, and catch Sanchia as she lands?
Basically. Then you both make a mad dash off the campo into the safety of the commons.
Sanchia cleared her throat again.
So, to review, she said slowly, I am floating up the canal.
Yes, said Orso.
In a submerged capsule you all have built in 3 days.
Yes.
And using Tribuno's blood to enter the mountain.
Yes.
And I am then navigating a completely unknown set of obstacles to get to the 35th floor, where I am then stealing the Imperiet.
Yes.
And then I hop off the mountain and fly to Gregor, because the mountain will probably figure out something's wrong and try to trap me.
Ah.
And once I land, we run off the campo while probably being chased by some armed people who noticed me flying through the sky like a bird.
Ah. Probably. Yes.
And then I give the Imperiet to you and you
take down Tomas,
said Orso.
He coughed. And possibly use it to reinvent the nature of scrying as we know it.
Yes, well then, I see. She took a breath, nodded, and sat up.
I'm out.
Orso blinked.
You what? Out?
Yeah, I'm out. She stood. Every time we talk about this, it gets more and more preposterous. And no one's asked me once if I'm game for any of this. I'm not doing this mad shit. I'm not. I'm out.
She walked away. There was a long, awkward silence. Orso stared around at everyone, flabbergasted.
Did she just say she's out?
She did,
said Claudia.
Like, not going to do it?
That's what out generally means,
said Gio.
But she can't. She can't just, oh, son of a bitch.
He chased after Sanchia and caught her just as she was slipping out into the tunnel.
Hey, come back here.
No, said Sanchia.
We did a hell of a lot of work for you,
snarled Orso.
We worked our goddamn asses off to set this all up. You can't just walk out now.
And yet, said Sanchia,
that's what I'm doing. But this is our only chance. If we don't steal the Imperiet now, then Tomas Ziani could raise an army and...
And what? Spat Sanchia, marching up to him. Do to Tavan what Tavan has done to the entire rest of the world?
You don't know what the hell you're talking about.
The problem is that I actually do. You're not the one in the capsule, in the mountain, the one risking your goddamn neck. You know what this is? What this really is?
What?
Said Orso, fuming.
This is a rich man's fight, said Sanchia. A rich man's game, and we're all just pieces on the board to you. You think you're different, Orso, but you're just like all the rest of them. She put her finger in his face. My life's not a hell of a lot better since I escaped the plantation.
I still starve a lot, and I still get beaten occasionally. But at least now I get to say no when I want to. And I'm saying it now.
She turned and walked out.
Chapter 25. Sanchia sat on the hilltop next to the gulf, staring out at the ramshackle tent city, rambling and gray in the watery late morning light. She'd felt alone many times since she'd found Clef, but she hadn't felt truly abandoned until now, burdened with secrets and surrounded with people all too willing to either kill her or put her in harm's way.
"We're in a right state, aren't we, kid?" said Clef.
"Yeah. I don't know what the hell to do, Clef. I want to run, but I've nowhere to run to." Sanchia watched a group of children playing in the gulf, running back and forth with sticks. Skinny things, undernourished and filthy. Her childhood had been much the same. Even in the greatest city on earth, she thought. Children go hungry every day.
"I bet I could take the mountain," said Clef. "Forget about Orso. You and me, kid, we could do it."
"We're not discussing this, Clef."
"I could. It'd be interesting. A feat. An experience."
"It's the goddamn graveyard of thieves, Clef. Campo operators like Sark talked about it in whispers like the thing could hear them across the city."
"I want to get you out of this. I got you into it. And I don't think I have a lot of time left, Sanchia. I want to do something, I don't know, something big."
She buried her face in her hands. "Damn it," she whispered. "Damn it all."
"The captain's coming," said Clef. "He's got his truncheon. He's walking up the hill now."
"Great," she thought. "Another conversation I don't want to have." She watched as his lumbering form emerged from the tall weeds. He did not look at her. He just walked over and sat about 10 feet away.
"Dangerous to be out in the day," he said.
"It's dangerous to be in there, too," said Sanchia, "since you people want to get me killed."
"I don't want to get you killed, Sanchia."
"You said to me once that you were not afraid to die. You meant it, didn't you?" He thought about it and nodded. "Yeah. A guy who's not afraid to die likely isn't too torn up about getting other people killed. You might not want it, but it's a responsibility you're willing to accept, isn't it?"
"Responsibility,"
he echoed.
"You know, I talked to my mother yesterday."
"That's why you ducked out? Just to chat up your mother?"
"Yes. I asked her about Silicio. And she admitted that once Dandolo Chartered had indeed been involved in trying to scribe human beings. In trying to scribe slaves, I mean."
She glanced at him. His face was fixed in a look of quiet puzzlement. "Really?"
"Yes,"
he said quietly.
"Odd thing to learn of your family's complicity in such monstrosities. But like you said, it's not like there weren't plenty of other tragedies and monstrosities to begin with. That particular one is not especially unusual. So now, today, I think about responsibilities."
He looked out at the cityscape of Tavan.
"It won't change on its own, will it?"
"What, the city?"
"Yes. I'd hoped to civilize it, to show it the way. But I no longer think it will change of its own accord. It must have change forced upon it."
"Is this about justice again?" asked Sanchia.
"Of course. It's my responsibility to deliver it."
"Why you, Captain?"
"Because of what I've seen."
"And what's that?" He sat back.
You know they call me the Revenant of Dantua, yes?"
She nodded.
"People call me that, but they don't know what it means. Dantua. It was a Daolo city we took, in the north of the Durazzo. But the Daolos in the city had stockpiles of flash powder," he said. "I've no idea how they'd gotten it,
But one day, some boy, no older than 10, snuck into our camp with a box of it on his back. And he ran up to our lexicon and set off the charge. Killed himself. Set fire to the camp. And worse, he damaged the lexicon. So all our rigs failed. So we were just stuck there, with the Daolo armies out beyond. They couldn't penetrate the fortress, even with us helpless. But they could starve us out. So we starved, for days, for weeks. We knew they'd kill us if we surrendered. So we just starved and hoped someone would come. We ate rats and boiled corn cobs and mixed dirt with our rice. I just sat and watched it all happen. I was the air commander, but there was nothing I could do. I watched them die. Of starvation. Of suicide. I watched these proud sons turn to anguished skeletons, and I buried them in the meager earth. And then, one day, some of the men had meat. I found them cooking it in the camps, sizzling on skillets. It did not take me long to realize what kind of meat it was. Carcasses were in high supply in Dantua, after all. I wanted to stop them, but I knew if I tried, they'd mutiny.
He shut his eyes.
Then the men started getting sick. Perhaps a consequence of what they were doing. Consume ill flesh, become ill yourself. Swollen armpits, swollen necks. It spread so fast. We started running out of places to bury corpses. It was no surprise that I caught the plague myself, eventually. I remember the fever, the coughing, the taste of blood in my mouth. I remember my men watching me as I lay on my bed, gasping. Then things went dark, and when I awoke, I was in the grave under the earth.
Wait, you survived? They buried you and you woke up inside the grave?
Yes,
he said quietly.
It's extremely rare, but some people do survive the plague. I awoke in the dark with things on top of me, blood and dirt and filth in my mouth. I couldn't see anything, could barely breathe, so I had to dig my way out. Through the bodies, through all that earth, through the rot and the piss and the blood and...
He fell silent.
I don't know how I did it, but I did. I clawed until my fingernails were sloughed off and my fingers were broken and my hands bloody. But then I saw it. Saw the light flickering through the cracks in the corpses above me. And I crawled out and saw the fire. The Morsinis had gotten to Dantua. They'd attacked. The Daolos had broken in through the walls in desperation, and somehow they'd set the city alight. And some Morsini sergeant saw me clawing my way out of the mass grave, covered in blood and mud and screaming. He thought I was a monster. And by that point, perhaps I was. The revenant of Dantua.
They were silent. The tall grasses danced in the wind around them.
I've seen a lot of deaths, Anshia,
he said.
My father and brother died in a carriage accident when I was young. One I nearly died in myself. I joined the military to bring honor to their name. But instead I got so many young men killed. And again, I survived. I keep surviving, it seems. It's taught me many things. After Dantua, it was like a magic spell had been lifted from my eyes. We are making these horrors. We are doing this to ourselves. We have to change. We must change.
This is just what people are, said Sanchia. We're animals. We only care about survival.
But don't you see,
he said.
Don't you see that's a bond they've placed upon you? Why did you work the fields as a slave? Why did you sleep in miserable quarters and silently bear your suffering? Because if you didn't, you'd be killed, Sanchia. So long as you think only of survival, only of living to see the next day, you will always bear their chains. You will not be free. You'll always